tonight. Each side has 15 minutes. I've been looking forward to argument all week when we have two Ninth Circuit clerks coming back before us to argue. It's a proud moment for everyone, and I know Mr. Sprinkling, you clerked for Justice Kennedy as well, I believe. So thank you both for being here. And are you doing this pro bono?
We are, yes.
Not through the court pro bono program?
No, it's CJA counsel.
All right. Well, thank you both for your good work in this, and we're ready to hear your arguments.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, may it please the court, as Judge Callahan just mentioned, my name is Thomas Sprinkley, and I represent Mr. Richards in this action. Your Honors, and if I can, I'll try to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, but I recognize that's not a given.
Your Honors, the drill.
This case turns on the events of March 8, 2020. That morning, police officers in Oakland found two firearms along a public highway. Although there was no evidence directly connecting Mr. Richards to those firearms, and by that I mean no DNA evidence, no fingerprints, no proof of ownership, the government concluded that he had possessed those firearms and alleged that that violated a term of his supervised release. Now, the district court agreed and sentenced Mr. Richards to two separate sentences, one 24-month sentence for possession of the firearms and one 24-month sentence for possession of the ammunition. Your Honors, we submit that that ruling was...
Is it clear that that's how the sentencing was? Because, you know, there's some confusion in the transcript as to whether or not the court was supposed to sentence per charge of the probation violation document or per count. And, you know, it seems that what the court did was just kind of assess all of the violations as a whole and all the factors under the statute, adopted a 48 months, and then split it between the two counts of conviction, the original count. So is it clear that the record establishes that there was 24 months for one of the probation charges and 24 months for the other, and that they were stacked?
So, Your Honor, yes, the record was a little confusing because some of the original convictions were written as counts and some were written as charges. But my understanding from the record is that there was, you know, there was a firearm possession count and there was a drug trafficking count. And for each of those, right, was a violation of supervised release was attached. And one of those violations was charge three, which was possession of either the Taurus or the Glock 17 firearm. And one of those violations was charge four, which was possession of ammunition.
But weren't there two guns?
There were two guns,
and
that is correct.
I saw places in the record where the judge referred to that there were, that he was finding him, well, finding that it to be proven that there were, that he possessed two guns on two separate occasions.
Your Honor, I would respectfully quibble with that just a little bit. There were two guns that Mr. Richards is alleged to have possessed, a Glock 17 and a Taurus.
The one that he allegedly threw out of the car, and then the other one that he threw out of the truck when he got arrested throwing things out of his truck.
Yes, that's right, Your Honor. The Taurus was found along the side of the freeway, and the Glock 17 was found near an off-ramp in a grassy area. So yes, there were... Oh, sorry, go ahead, Judge Collins.
But I'm looking at the judgment. And so the judgment on the first page finds that he committed four violations, and they're listed as charge 3, 4, 5, and 6, and the term is charge 3, charge 4, charge 5, charge 6. And then the sentence of imprisonment is that he's committed to the custody of the Bureau of Prisons for a total term of 48 months, which consists of 24 months as to count 1, mm-hmm. not any charge, not charge 3, not charge 4, and 24 months as to count 3, all to run consecutively. So where do we have as the necessary factual predicate for your argument that 24 months was assigned to one gun and 24 months was assigned to ammunition? Or how do we have it that presenting the sort of keen issue?
Yes, Your Honor, it's where I see it is in ER 14 to ER 15, which is where the court provides his limited reasoning for finding that the allegations were proven. He says that I find at a minimum charges 3 and 4, possession of a firearm and possession of ammunition have been amply proved by a preponderance of the evidence. And I believe that there's a later discussion on when they talk about those counts matching up, those charges matching up to the counts. But that's the cleanest I can point you to, Your Honor.
Where does it say, where in the record is the assignment of 24 months to one of the charges and 24 months to one of the others?
Your Honor, there's a discussion in the sentencing hearing where probation is involved. And the question, and this is actually pretty important, was whether there should be two 24-month sentences, whether they run consecutively or concurrently. And originally, the probation officer said, I believe, concurrently, and then later switched it to consecutively. So that's where you can see that there are two separate supervised release violations. And I'm happy to find that in a second. But I believe that's near the end of the proceeding.
If you want to supply it on rebuttal, yeah. You can
so
do I, that.
Sorry, Your Honor, ER 39, the court says, it is here. So the sentence will be imposed as follows. The term of supervised release is hereby revoked, and the client, James Richard, is hereby sentenced to the custody of the Bureau of Prisons for a period of 48 months. This term shall consist of 24 months on count 3 and 24 months on count 4 to run consecutively. And if they weren't separate convictions, then you wouldn't have had the concurrent consecutive question at all.
But that gets corrected a few pages later on 43, because the government stands up and says, no, you can't sentence on charges. You have to, these are punishments for the original offenses, which are count 1 and count 3. And then he redoes it on 43 and assigns it to count 1 and count 3.
I think I understand where you're coming from on this, Your Honor. Our position is, yes, that as a matter of kind of by the book, these were connected to the original crimes of conviction. That's generally how supervised release works. But the conduct that led to those additional violations was the firearm charge and the ammunition charge. And I'm happy after oral argument goes to do my best to supplement the record on that or submit a short letter brief. But I would like to briefly talk about some of the other issues in this case, if I may.
Let's jump to, is there any published opinion following United States v. Hayman that holds that a violation of a condition of supervised release may not be decided by a judge based on the preponderance of the evidence? And I would also kind of segue into, appellant admits that he did not raise the constitutional challenge to consecutive sentences in the district court, and in light of the Ninth Circuit's opinion in United States versus Henderson, you know, what's your best argument that the district court plainly erred in issuing the sentence?
Yes. So the first answer is easy. There's no published decision on point. In fact, we're not aware of any court that has ruled on specifically on the G2 issue. In terms of plain error, I think the answer is threefold. First, Hayman is a relatively recent decision. It was issued in 2019. Courts are still figuring out the repercussions, and no other court, as I mentioned, has gotten to G2. Second, if you look at footnote 7 in the Hayman plurality opinion, the court calls out specifically G as a section that could be affected. It certainly doesn't say we hold that our ruling extends to this, but it does specifically name it. And third, and I think this goes to our merits point, we think that Justice Breyer's three factors, which Your Honor held and Henderson were controlling, are so strongly on point that they should have been a clear guide to the district court here. And one that I particularly want to single out to you is the very first factor, which is that the sentence is tied to a discrete set of federal crimes. In this case, Mr. Richards was alleged to have been possession of a firearm. Part of the government's case was that he was a felon in possession under state law. And they actually, if you look at SER 62, threatened in a future case that they might charge him under 922G1, the federal offense for felon in possession of a firearm. This seems to go right to Justice Breyer's concern that rather than using supervised release in the classic sense, say under E3, where it's a flexible consideration, it looks more like K. It's a way of getting around the usual protections of a crime. In this case, of course, there was no jury, and the standard was preponderance rather than beyond a reasonable doubt.
Can I ask a question about a threshold ambiguity in Justice Breyer's concurrence? On that factor, he says, first, section 3583K applies only when a defendant commits a discrete set of federal criminal offenses specified in the statute. There's actually two specifications of federal criminal offenses in the statute. One in the first sentence, which says the persons to whom K applies, and then in the second sentence, which says that when those people commit one of these offenses is the violation, then this follows. So this, is it clear that he's referring to the second enumeration and not the first?
That's a good question, Your Honor. It is not clear to me, but I think what he was trying to do is lay out a general set of principles that guide the analysis. And you know, clearly, we're not saying this applies to all of the supervised release statute. What we're saying is, at least based on the consideration he mentioned, which was tied to a discrete set of federal offenses, it is quite similar.
It would matter here because this one only has what the equivalent, the analog to the second sentence. It doesn't have the analog to the first sentence.
Your Honor, could you explain that point one more time for me just to make sure I understand your issue?
Yeah. So the statute here, which is G, applies to anyone who commits any offense who then possesses a firearm in violation of federal law. So it's got an enumeration that looks like the second sentence of K, but it doesn't have the limited universe enumeration as to whom G applies to the way that K does in the first sentence.
I believe I understand your point. Yeah. Yes. So admittedly, they're not identical statutes because Justice Breyer analyzed K. But as I mentioned, I think the underlying theme in his very short opinion was the government shouldn't be able to sneak a crime in the back door through supervised release, something that they would generally need a jury trial for. And regardless of whether there's a limited
universe. You really need this sentence to be talking about in his first, to be talking about the second sentence, that he's really relying on the enumeration in the second sentence that, anyone who commits... He's focused on the violation of supervised release and not on the underlying federal offense having been enumerated.
Your Honor, all I can tell you is that how I read that provision is that his concern was trying to map, that the government would try to map federal crimes into the supervised release context. I think here, for the reasons I've articulated, the best I can do is to tell you the G2 references a specific set of federal crimes, those which are possession of a firearm in violation of federal law. Unfortunately, that's our position, and I do quickly want to address a couple of other things, but if you have further questions on that position, I'm happy to answer.
Well, do we have the third factor here? That's the one that seems to be missing.
So the third factor is whether the statute limits discretion by imposing a mandatory minimum. It minimizes what a judge can do. I think that's met here for two reasons. So one is that the judge is required to impose a sentence of some kind, right? It's not optional to put the defendant in prison. And second, there is some limitation on time, although it's not quite the same as K. The statute is phrased in the future tense. It's to serve time, or to serve, I think, for a term of imprisonment, which would at least seem to take away the possibility of time served. So I would say that yes, that the third factor is met. It's a different statute, but it has the same criteria.
Counsel, I want to go back to something that you said a few minutes ago because I think maybe I misunderstood you. I understood you to say that no court had addressed G. G2 under these circumstances. They have addressed G.
Yes.
But
yes.
Not G2.
That's correct. Okay. And I think this matters because G2 is the provision that speaks most directly to the discrete set of federal crimes. As my colleague on the other side has pointed out, G3 and G4 speak more to general terms of supervised release. So our challenge is limited to just.
So the decisions of the Third, Fourth, and Fifth Circuits are dealing with a different subsection?
I believe so, yes. The only case of the one sided that we found that dealt with firearm possession was a double jeopardy case and not a question under Haymond.
Let me ask you about Henderson. Didn't Henderson, even though technically addressed a different, slightly different point, doesn't the opinion reject the application of Apprendi and Alleyn to determinations of violations of supervised release?
Your Honor, I agree that it did address a slightly different point. It was a challenge to E3, I believe, or E in that context. And there they were relying on the pluralities theory that if you could be sentenced to, if the supervised
release...
But doesn't it
implicitly reject?
I don't think so, because I think that...
Thought I did, but
I can never argue with the person who wrote the opinion. But coming at it as a neutral observer, my reading would be that it does not, because I was talking about the pluralities theory, whereas we all agree that Justice Breyer's concurrence controls.
So, if from your view it wasn't addressed, does it need to be addressed? And has any circuit come to the conclusion that you would be entitled to a jury trial under these circumstances?
So the question in the The G2 question we do think needs to be addressed, and we do think that it entitles Mr. Richards to a jury trial. The E question is not presented in our case because, much like Mr. Haymond, Mr. Richards' sentences resulting from supervised release were still under the statutory maximum. So that's not an argument we've made here, and so I would say that Henderson is not on point for that, although it does acknowledge that Justice Breyer's concurrence is the controlling test. So I would like to talk briefly about the double jeopardy point, recognizing that the Judge Collins and I unfortunately may have difference of opinion on precisely what happened below, but to briefly lay out our theory, and I'm happy to respond to questions at that point. What happened here, if you look at the amended petition, which is the relevant charging document, there were six different violations of supervised release charged. One of those the court found was not proven. Another one was dismissed. Two were admitted. That left us with the two in this case, the possession of the firearm and the possession of the ammunition. Those issues were proved up in front of a trial court. There was a hearing. There was evidence. And the court found, in the passages I've read you, that that was what justified the time in prison. And that's why he ended up with two 24-month sentences. And Judge Collins, as I'm talking, I'm even thinking another reason why I can lay this out more clearly. 3583E talks about Class A violations, Class B violations, and Class C violations, and maybe even Class D violations. But what that says is there's a maximum amount of time you can do for each of those violations, and the sentencing guidelines provides guidance for that. And so the guideline range, as I understand, for a Class B violation combined with the original crimes of offense was 18 to 24 months. So I don't think anybody argued below that a single one of those charges, that charge three or charge four alone, could have supported a 48-month sentence. What happened was the government wanted to establish, there was a threats crime that the government was trying to establish, and that's where they got the 48 months from. They failed to meet their burden on that, largely because they relied on hearsay evidence, and then the judge was struggling to come up with another way to get to the same result, which was two 24-month sentences.
So do either of you have questions? Because he's already in overtime, but I'm happy to have the judges ask you more questions.
I am just curious on this. Why a consecutive sentence? So if it's as long as each one of those is within the guideline, 18 to 24, where's the what standard do we use for deciding whether it violates double jeopardy to do those consecutively? They're independent of each other. I understand they're related.
Well, I wouldn't say they're independent. They arise from the same transaction or occurrence. So as far as we can tell, the only evidence in the record of ammunition is in the Glock 17.
Sure, but if he had had controlled substances and a gun, those would have been two separate violations, even though they were both in the same bag in the cab of a truck.
That's true, but if you look at the Keene decision, there's an early footnote that talks about this, and what it discusses is when you have multiple guns in the same course of conduct. For example, I suppose if you found three guns in a closet, at least under 922G1, that would count as one transaction. It wouldn't count as three transactions.
Mm-hmm. But the ammo was set out separately in the terms of the supervised release. So if he had just had ammo, he could get 24 months, couldn't he?
Under the logic of Keene, right, which is about 922G1, which uses very similar language as the terms of supervised release, the terms use the phrase any when they talk about what he wasn't allowed to possess. He wasn't allowed to possess any firearms, ammunition, and a couple of other things.
Right. So if we had only found a box of shotgun shells, he could get 24 months on that. Mm-hmm. If we had only found an unloaded gun with no ammunition, he could have gotten 24 months on that. Mm-hmm. So these are separate violations.
So again, under the logic of Keene, they're the same basic transaction. So Keene dealt with a situation where someone was sentenced to two different sentences for a gun and the ammunition within it. So this court, at least as of 1996, in a published opinion, had rejected the notion that those are two separate transactions.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We've taken you in overtime, but I'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
All right. We'll hear from the government. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Annie Shea, and I represent the United States in this appeal. This court should affirm the revocation sentence for three reasons. First, the district court did not commit plain error in revoking Richard's supervised release term because 18 U.S.C. Section 3583 G2 remains constitutional after Haymond. Second, the district court properly imposed two consecutive sentences based on the revocation of Richard's two supervised release terms. And third, sufficient evidence supports the district court's findings that Richards possessed firearms and ammunition in violation of his supervised release. Now, because the court asked my colleague about the double jeopardy issue first, I'd like to clarify some points as to that issue. So Richards' argument that he was essentially punished twice for the same conduct seems to misunderstand either the record here or how supervised release works, or both. The argument makes a mistake of adopting the view that the Supreme Court in Johnson and this court's precedent has disavowed, which is a supervised release revocation is not punishment for a new offense. It's typically understood as part of the penalty for the initial offense. So in other words, it's a sanction for the defendant.
As I read Justice Breyer's concurrence, what it's essentially saying is that when you have these three factors, it essentially is punishment for the other offense. And that's essentially, so you have the enumeration of the violation, so it's a discrete set, and then it takes away the discretion of the judge and limits the discretion in a particular matter, and then it, he says, it more closely resembles the punishment of new criminal offenses. So it's really kind of a three-factor test for taking the situation out of Johnson's rule that it's punishment for the original offense. Am I reading his concurrence incorrectly?
Yes, Your Honor. I would agree to a large extent with your view of Justice Breyer's concurrence. I think that what Justice Breyer, the crux of his analysis there, and again, he did identify three aspects of 3583K that considered in combination made it closer to what he deemed punishment for a new offense versus ordinary revocation. So I think it's important first to understand how ordinary revocation works, which typically operates under Section E of 3583, and then how punishment for a new offense might look like under Section K. And just to kind of...
I'm a little confused, maybe, and I had that, you have it in your brief, and it came up, I think, with Mr. Sprankling, that if you could explain to me, do we have to determine whether Mr. Richards' consecutive sentences stem from his supervised release violations or from his original counts of conviction, and what's the impact? I know you talk in there about whether it comes from the conviction or the supervised release, and I'm a little confused.
Yes, Your Honor, that is actually very important, and I think part of that stems, first of all, again, from how supervised release works under Section E. And so when, I'll just use this case as an example because it might be a little bit difficult to understand, but Richards was convicted originally of two counts. First, it was a Title 21, a drug possession count, and then he had a violation of 924C. The original sentence for these two counts included both terms of imprisonment and terms of supervised release. Those terms of supervised release, there were two of them, but they ran concurrently. So essentially, what E3 provides for is that when you violate your supervised release and a revocation occurs, it is tied to the term of supervised release. And so once that happens, the court was authorized to impose two and only two terms of imprisonment. It doesn't matter how many different ways he violated his supervised release. Once he was found to have violated it, the court was authorized under Section E to revoke both terms and then either impose consecutive or concurrent terms of a sanction, basically, based off of both revocations. And I'm not sure if that clarifies what occurred here. And so there was confusion in the record. It seems that in the beginning, the court also kept referring to charges 3 and 4 of the petition or the revocation petition.
So with the clarification, as the judge went along, what do you believe the record shows happened?
Well, I think this was certainly clarified by the end of the hearing, and I would point the court, I think it was an ER, I believe, give me one second, look at this.
So your position, counsel, then, is that the fact that there was both a firearm and ammunition, which each of which would have been an independent violation if they'd been found alone, is irrelevant. That what the district court really was doing was tying this to the convictions and not to the prior convictions, not to the two violations of the supervised release.
Yes, Your Honor. And I would point this court to other cases of supervised release revocations. For Campbell, for example, this is cited in the government's brief. That was a case in which the original counts, there are 35 counts of mail fraud, which resulted in 35 sentences, essentially, which included 35 terms of supervised release. In that particular case, what ended up happening was once there was a single violation found, the court imposed what was five consecutive six-month terms of imprisonment for five of the counts and then 31-day terms of imprisonment concurrently. And again,
this guidelines, what do the guidelines say about how to sentence multiple violations of supervised release conditions? Because in the normal context, there's all kinds of grouping rules and exception to grouping rules.
Yes, Your Honor.
The guideline itself seems somewhat silent about it. How did it work here?
Well, Your Honor, in Campbell, this court expressly addressed that the guidelines does still allow the court to impose either consecutive or concurrent sentences after revoking supervised release.
Well, of course you can do that, but if you know, you can determine a total sentence and then allocate it among the counts. But how was the range calculated here? Because at one point in the discussion, the judge seems to think that there's two guideline ranges that get stacked, that there's a 0 to 24 for each of the relevant violation charges here, charge 3 and charge 4. And then seem to think that that gave you a 0 to 48 range. And that kind of thinking seems to suggest, you know, that the judge was operating on the kind of multiple punishment that counsel, your opponent, is contending. But it was done in the course of thinking through the guidelines. Am I wrong?
Well, Your Honor, yes. And just to clarify what happened in the record here. So originally there were five charges in the petition. And the petition held with charge 1 was a grade A violation, and then the other charges were either grade B or grade C violations. So the grade of the violation is what feeds into what the sentencing guidelines will provide for what the sentencing guidelines range is. So if Mr. Richards had been found guilty of charge 1, which is what was expected by probation and the government going into this sentencing hearing, he would have been exposed to that 48-month range. But during the hearing, and again, this occurs later on when the judge makes the finding that he would not be finding Mr. Richards guilty of charge 1, probation then said, well, now that there are grade B violations left, the maximum under the guidelines is now 24 months. So what the guidelines provides for is that we look at...
But then what the court says is, so the lay of the land is what we have is I have found charges 3 and 4 proved, charges 5 and 6 were admitted, and where that leaves us, based on the discussion we all just had, given that these are grade B violations, is that we have a criminal history category of 5, and for the grade B violations, the advisory range for each is 18 to 24 months. So it seemed that the judge thought that the result is that you stack them and get 0 to 48.
I think, Your Honor, that with that particular provision or that particular colloquy perhaps occurred earlier, I think, in the hearing. I think that by the end of the hearing, much of this was clarified by both the probation office when the court came back after a break and the probation office explained, again, that each of the sentences would be tied to the original counts of conviction. And for each of those counts, they carried the range of 18 to 24 months because of the grade B violation.
Right, but there's a difference between calculating a guideline range, which is aggregate. That's usually how it's done. And then allocating it, once you've determined it, to the underlying counts of convictions where you have to obey the stat maxes and allocate it out. But it seemed that at that first stage, looking at the guidelines, the judge was stacking the 2, 3, and 4, rather than what we would call in the normal context, grouping them, and came up with a range of 0 to 48 rather than a range of 0 to 24.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, I think that The main point here, though, is that the calculation with the understanding of what range was applicable was clarified by the end of this hearing. And I do admit that there was a bit of confusion, I think, earlier on with how the court construed what the applicable guidelines range would be.
Is there any relevance that there were two guns in the double jeopardy argument? Or is it... I'm trying to understand Mr. Sprankling's argument on Keene.
And my understanding, again, is that his argument is that Mr. Richards was essentially punished twice for having two guns, which, if this were a criminal trial and this were a 922G charge, then that would not be permitted if they were possessed simultaneously. Of course, there's exceptions to that. Again, this is not a criminal trial. This is not a Keene case. Keene pertained to how 922G should be interpreted, and in that particular case, the Ninth Circuit found that Congress did not intend that particular statute to permit the prosecution of a simultaneous possession of two firearms.
Mr. Sprankling also contends that his client was entitled to be judged by a jury and not by a judge in the preponderance of the evidence, and that that Henderson didn't implicitly find otherwise. What's your position on that?
Well, Your Honor, I would agree that this is probably an implicit holding of Henderson as far as the constitutionality of G, given how Henderson viewed Hayman in general. However, you know, I do also recognize that Henderson did not directly address 3583G. However, other circuits have. And to Mr. Sprankling's point that his argument here, G2, might be different from G, I would take a look at each of those cases that have decided that G remains constitutional after Hayman, because they do look at all of G, including subsection G2, and they do walk through Justice Breyer's analysis in determining why section G overall is constitutional. And to that extent, I do think that if we look at those factors, that very first factor, which whether or not the statute is limited to situations where a defendant commits a discrete set of federal criminal offenses, G2 is, again, much broader than this. Even though the statute does include federal offenses and it does cite federal law for the definition of a firearm, it also includes just the conduct of firearm possession in general, including that which may or may not rise to the level of a federal offense.
So here Mr. Richards is found with two guns, but if he had only been found in possession of a single gun with ammunition for that gun, could he be given consecutive sentences for possessing the gun and for possessing the ammo?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. If he had been only found in violation of his... If he had been only found in violation of supervised release by one charge, he would have been given two sentences. Now, those could have run concurrently, or those could have run consecutively. The court had the discretion to decide which way to impose those sentences.
So is there any limit to the length of sentence that the district court could have imposed for Mr. Richards' violations of conditions of supervised release? And if so, what would that limit be?
Well, the limitations here, Your Honor, again, come under E3. And so under E3, it says that when a term of supervised release is revoked for a Class A felony, when that's the original conviction, the cap is 5 years. And when it's a Class B, it's 3 years. And when it's the Class C or D, it's 2 years. So here what Mr. Richards had was he had a Class A felony in count three, and he had a Class, I think it was a C felony in count one. And so, again, those counts each carried different statutory maximums as far as what he could be imposed. And again, that's why it's important to understand why there are two sentences here. There would always be two sentences, whether or not they're run concurrently or consecutively. And so with this particular case, again, those are the caps there, and the court was well within the maximums of E3. And then just to that point, I think that's one of the important aspects that makes G2 very different from K. I think if you look at if you just look at how Haymond, how that case was conducted and then the problems with Kay there. I mean, Heyman was, he committed a child pornography offense originally, which had a maximum of 10 years imprisonment. And then when he violated his supervised release with another child pornography offense, under E3, on revocation, he would have been capped at 2 years if his sentence had been, his supervised release had been revoked and he had been sentenced to imprisonment. Unfortunately, with Kay, what Kay did was require a 5-year mandatory minimum. And so it essentially went from what was a maximum of 2 years imprisonment to 5 years. And the judge in the Heyman case actually found that quite repugnant that the statute would do that. And that's the issue that came all the way up to the Supreme Court, in which the Supreme Court found unconstitutional. That's simply not what has occurred here. We have instead a statute that is very much still tied to the ordinary revocation statute, which is subsection E. And again, the court had the full discretion upon revocation to decide whether what term of imprisonment Richards warranted. And based off the record here, the court was very thoughtful about the sentence it imposed. It clearly felt that a 48-month sentence was appropriate given the egregiousness of Mr. Richards' breach of trust of the supervised release terms, and that was part of the reason he decided to impose consecutive sentences there. And again, based off of the 3553A factors that he cited in his reasoning, the sentence was well within his discretion.
Do either of my colleagues have any questions? All right. I've let you go a little over because we took Mr. Sprankling over, so thank you.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
All right, you have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, I want to take a step back and focus on the double jeopardy issue. And I think we got a little tangled up in the weeds of precisely how the sentence was handed down, but our point is this. Mr. Richards was sentenced for 2 charges. They were proved up at trial. The judge found they were proved by preponderance of the evidence. One was possession of a firearm. One was possession of ammunition. Traditionally, under the Keene case that we've cited to you, that would be a violation of the double jeopardy clause. That's the starting point.
Okay. Now, if we disagree with the premises, if we thought that you had a firearm, a loaded firearm, either the ammo or the firearm would have been sufficient, and you're being charged, he's violated both his drug conviction and his firearm conviction, then do you have a double jeopardy argument?
So I don't think that the ammunition and the firearm could be independent based on the Keene reasoning. And
let's just take those out. Let's,
yeah.
we've
okay.
It turns out that either one of those would be sufficient. But let's suppose that the judge just says, "Look, you're found with a loaded gun, and that violates both your drug charge, the supervised conditions for your drug charge."
Yeah.
And the 924, 922, whatever it was, the prior.
And I'm glad you raised that point, Judge Bybee, because as I understand the government's position, a single bullet would have justified both of these two-year sentences.
But why would that violate the double jeopardy clause?
Yeah.
No, I've shifted it just a little bit. I understand there's some ambiguity in the record.
Yes, so this is the best I can say, Your Honor, is that double jeopardy is a flexible concept. This court has held it. The Supreme Court has held it, specifically in the appealability context.
And that means that we get to do whatever we darn well please.
Well, if you're not satisfied with double jeopardy, the due process clause provides a backstop in these circumstances. And I would submit, Your Honors, that a situation where, as the government suggests, someone could be sentenced to 4 years in prison based on a preponderance of the evidence, without a jury, based on a single bullet in their pocket, does seem to be very, very serious due process concerns.
So, are you saying that just taking the violations to charges 3 and 4 that, without anything more, even if the sentences had been concurrent, that violated double jeopardy? I mean, because we don't allow double convictions for overlapping offenses based on the same double jeopardy rationale. Is that your argument, that's essentially the principle here, that 3 and 4 both shouldn't have been taken?
I think the consecutive what poses the problem here. If they were concurrent, then he would just be subject to a 2-year sentence, and I think there would be a harmless error problem potentially. But in this case, they are separate, and he is serving 2 separate jail periods. I mean, I guess, so if your question is, in theory, would there be a constitutional violation? I suppose, But it's certainly much more dramatic here when it literally doubled the length of his sentence, again, based on a preponderance of the evidence, which was quite thin. And we haven't had a chance to go into that, but I do hope you take a close look at the end of our briefs, which discuss it in some detail. Your Honors, I know I'm past my time. Thank you for your time.
Let me find out if either of my colleagues have questions. Run back to the council table. I think we're done.
I'm happy to stay up here as long as you want. But thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate it.
Thank you both for your argument. I'm speaking for myself, but you both did the Ninth Circuit proud today. And in my view, I think we had the best argument on the last day on Friday. So thank you both. This matter will stand submitted. This court is in recess for the week.